as we enter the week of the Sweet 16s and the Elite Eights of the Men's and Women's National Championship. We've still got a lot of things to talk about in regards to A-10 hoops. Welcome back to the A-10 Talk Podcast. I'm Sam Basil alongside Daniel Frank. And Daniel, I feel like after last week's podcast, you know, we were talking about maybe, you know, putting this on hold for about a month and then moving into kind of our off-season mode. But I think what happened in the first couple rounds of the tournament, as well as what's going on in the men's NIT, really changed our plan. So Daniel, you know, how do you feel that we've still got a lot more A-10 hoops to talk about?
Whew. I mean, it's nice to not be fully in the off-season mode yet. I'm not fully ready to put the season to bed. And by God, we've certainly got enough news to talk about with the whole coaching situations. I think I got whiplash from following what's going on at Amherst and watching the mass exodus leave GW. And we got a whole lot of stuff we got to cover tonight. And I'm excited to still be talking A-10 hoops tonight.
Yeah. Even off the court. I mean, these past couple of days, I mean, just this past 24 hours, maybe even 12 hours have just been absolutely, you know, bonkers in the world of A-10 basketball. So we'll be getting into all of that, but first let's kind of do a bit of a retrospective. So in the men's and women's national championships, we have no teams remaining from the Atlantic 10 in both of these tournaments. But that being said, I think, you know, all four teams that were involved, obviously on the women's side, that being UMass and Dayton, and on the men's side, that being Davidson and Richmond, some really fun performances to talk about, and a lot, you know, that these programs can maybe take and build on for next year. So first let's talk about the women's side of things. Obviously Dayton, they fell to Georgia in the first round, 70-54. And then UMass in the first round of the NCAA tournament had a really great performance against Notre Dame. Obviously, you know, it can't be that great of a performance if you lose 89-78, but still, I mean, they fought to the last second. They kept clawing, specifically from Sam Breen, who had 31 points. She was 3-for-4 from 3-point range, had 2 steals, and Sydney Taylor had 21 points. Daniel, you know, how does this game kind of, and this performance punctuate UMass's, you know, excellent 2021-22 season? And also, what groundwork does this lay for next year?
I think this gives such tremendous confidence, I would have to say, to this UMass group. I mean, they went toe-to-toe with a Notre Dame team that, kind of looking back in retrospect, probably was sorely underseeded. I mean, they took an absolute beating from my Louisville Cardinals, you know, towards the end of the season. I think games like that probably hurt their, you know, the NCAA tournament seeding. I think they got upset by Miami as well in the ACC tournament, did Notre Dame. But I mean, boy, the way they came in the next night after they beat UMass and just smoked Oklahoma by like 40 points on their home floor, I think speaks to the level of play that Notre Dame's playing with right now. And for UMass to, I mean, look, UMass basically played Notre Dame dead even for about 34, 35 minutes. The first like 3 minutes of the game, 3 to 4 minutes, UMass got smoked. It was like, I want to say like 14-2, 14-4. They did not come out of the gates well. And then the last like 2 minutes, Notre Dame really kind of pulled away. But other than those few minutes, I mean, UMass played really, really evenly with this Notre Dame team. And we have to talk about, you know, Sam Breen's half-court shot. I mean, UMass has a lot to be proud of from this game.
Yeah, I think, let's talk about that shot, because I think someone, it might have been you, it could have been you or either Nathan, whoever was live tweeting that game. I think they meant to tag Sam Breen in a highlight, and then they actually tagged me.
Yeah, that was me.
But you know what? It was great, because then I watched the highlight and I was like, holy crap. So, you know, thank you for that.
You know, Nathan was at the game in person.
Oh yeah, he calling, was on the call,
calling
right?
On radio. Yeah. And so I was tweeting the game, and I went to go tag Sam Breen. I typed SAMB and hit the wrong one.
That's funny stuff. So yeah, you know, I mean, you know, on the A-10 Talk Twitter, we just get a little too excited. Oh, by the way, speaking of the A-10 Talk Twitter, just tonight we launched our Twitter community. It's a new feature from Twitter. To be honest, I'm not too sure how it works.
I'm not either. I feel like an old man asking questions about how the hell this works, but figure it out, I guess.
Twitter's rolling out a lot of new different features, you know, in terms of spaces. They got straight up podcasts now. So I think the community is just going to be a place where, you know, A10 Talk fans, and, you know, if you're making other communities fans of, you know, whatever you want to, you know, work on, can post, have discussions. So if you like A10 Talk, if you like listening to us, if you like talking about your favorite A10 teams, your favorite 15 teams now in college basketball, you should definitely check that out. You'll be able to find a link for that on our Twitter. But, you know, continuing on with UMass, moving into next year, I mean, we were talking right before we started recording, and I was looking at some Sam Breen stats, and I was like, Daniel, you know, she's done after this year, right? But you have something to the contrary.
Yeah, every single person on this UMass roster pretty much is coming back. All five of those starters. The only question mark heading into the offseason was really Destiny Phylloxi. She had used up her eligibility, but had one COVID year left. And she announced today, because initially we were kind of feeling that she was leaning the other way. She went through a senior night, but she reversed course and announced today on Twitter she's coming back, and the whole squad's going to run it back. And by God, UMass is looking like, you know, the front runners of you know, to be the favorites for the A10 next year, especially with Dayton taking a shot of losing their head coach in Shauna Green, which I know we're going to get to here in a moment. But I mean, boy, UMass is looking fierce for next season.
Yeah. So who else, you know, you know, they have all those returning players. Who else do you think would really have a chance of, you know, kind of dethroning UMass next year?
Yeah, it's probably a little early to tell. I think from some regard, just in the day and age we're in with the transfer portal, anything could happen still. And we're still very early on into this, you know, this offseason, the progression of how that's going to roll through. Rhode Island, I think, certainly has the ability to, especially if they can get some help through the transfer portal. The team I really have my eye on, truthfully, is St. Joe's. I've kind of said this in different spaces in time, but what St. Joe's was able to do this season, how young they are, making it to the semifinals in Wilmington, reminds me a lot of where UMass was a year ago about this time. Now, granted, it's not a perfect comparison. UMass had more talent than I think the St. Joe's group does, which is not a slight to them. I think this, as we saw from where UMass ended up this season, UMass was head and shoulders above. I think St. Joe's is going to be an interesting team, though, to follow next season in terms of where they go from here, how they develop the talent that they have. Obviously, you've got to make sure you're retaining those folks. But St. Joe's is going to be a really interesting one, I think, to watch as we move forward.
Yeah. So, you know, speaking of moving forward, it looks like Shauna Green, the most recent head coach of the Dayton women's basketball program, will be leaving. I think about 2 days ago, she just accepted the position as the head coach of the Illinois women's basketball team. So, Daniel, you know, she finishes her career at Dayton, 6 seasons, a 127-50 record, you know, just overall in the regular season, 5 Atlantic 10 regular season championships. So, you know, 4 NCAA tournament appearances and 2 Atlantic 10 tournament championships. You know, where does Shauna Green kind of rank in, you know, in terms of in recent Atlantic 10 women's coaches?
I mean, I don't think there's a question from what she was able to do on the floor. I mean, to get Dayton back to the NCAA tournament as an at-large this season was a huge thing. They won a game. I don't want to blow past that. They, you know, they won a first four game against DePaul, who was a very good team, who nearly beat UConn. They came within like an inch of beating UConn earlier in the season. And for Dayton to go out and shoot the lights out and win by 30 points going away, they hit 13 threes. Aaron Whalen had a career high 28 points. I don't want to, you know, make little of their accomplishment of winning a first four game. But man, Dayton is really going to look a lot different next season too. I mean, Shauna Green is.
They're going to be looking a lot different because of the transfer portal or just because a lot of their players are kind of aging out of the program?
Probably a bit of both, truthfully. I mean, Shauna Green knew how to keep her girls, and she knew how to, I mean, she built a unit of a team there. I mean, to go back to your original question, which my ADHD brain kind of skipped past for a second, she's got to rank up there with some of the best recent coaches we've seen. I mean, just the standard that she was able to reestablish at Dayton. I mean, for the longest time it was GW and Dayton, and they were just going at it. And then both of them had coaching changes, and GW's not been able to catch back up since Sippus left. Shauna Green elevated Dayton and got them to that continued standard again. And so moving into this off, I mean, they lose their three super seniors in Aaron Whelan, Jen Jaconi, and Arian Bradshaw. What happens with Caleb Whitehead and Tendon Magasa is anyone's guess. I mean, it's going to be interesting to see who they bring in, I guess, is the first thing. That's obviously going to set the tone for this. It sucks to lose Shauna. It really does. I know she was not always the most beloved coach in media circles and by opposing fans and stuff, but man, did she know how to coach a team to success. But the whole landscape of the conference is going to look very different if Dayton has even a minor rebuilding year next year, and they could be heading towards a more of a major rebuild next year.
I mean, do you think that's something that Dayton fans should be worried about? I mean, should they enter this possible rebuild era with a bit of reluctance, or do you think it's like a good way to kind of, you know, turn the page and see, you know, what that next head coach can do?
Yeah, I don't know. It's hard to speculate. I mean, it's hard to follow women's basketball coaching changes just because there's not as much media attention to it. We don't have the type of circus that we've seen with Amherst and UMass, you know, going on the last several days on Twitter. I think Dayton probably is the most attractive by far head coaching job in the conference, both from a resources standpoint, funding, exposure, fan support. I think Dayton is probably the number one women's basketball job in the conference. So they should be able to attract some. I mean, this is a homer take, an absolutely homer take. I'd love to see Jonathan Sippis get a shot there. I love him. Yes, I know him well from his days at GW. I just saw him in Wilmington, caught up with him. But someone like that could easily do so well at Dayton. I'm very curious to see kind of what direction they choose to go in here. If you'd asked Dayton fans, I think before, you know, middle of the season back in November, which team they thought would be making a coaching change this offseason, I doubt many would have said it would be the women's program and not the men. But interesting times. And it all just kind of, we'll have to see how this plays out and kind of what the next step is here for the Dayton Flyers.
Yeah. And before we move on to some of the men's stuff, there was kind of an interesting debate that I saw pop up on Twitter regarding just not really on an A-10 side of things, but just on a women's basketball side of things in general, in that people were talking about, you know, because obviously in the first four and the sub-regionals, you know, the first two rounds take place instead of being at a completely neutral site at various places around the country. The first two rounds take place at the what they call sub-regionals, which are, you know, on the home courts of the top 16 teams of the tournament. And so there's been a lot of debate. You know, people were saying, you know, people were arguing about how much home court advantage plays into things, but more specifically about whether or not that's good for growing the game of women's basketball. And whether or not, you know, by having your team play on a home court in the postseason will help bring in more fans. I have to agree, even though I am a fan of neutral sites. So I was just kind of curious as to like what your thoughts are, you know, on the possibility of this being implemented on the men's side. I mean, I know we see it in the NIT, CBI, et cetera, kind of more out of necessity than out of choice. But, you know, I was just wondering if you'd like to see that, you know, presented on the men's side of the NCAA tournament.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I've experienced firsthand how raucous those buildings can be first and second rounds. Louisville's hosted the last, like, I want to say 10 years in a row, practically, it's been. And I've gotten to go to Louisville hosting first and second rounds, as well as they've hosted regional final once before as well. And it is a raucous venue. I mean, it's all the things that make college basketball great about home venues absolutely translate well, I think, to postseason. That being said, there is something about neutral courts, I think, that make the postseason special in themselves too. It creates a different stage, literally and metaphorically, I suppose, for postseason play. It's why it was so important, I know, to the women's basketball coaches that the women's A-10 tournament returned to all 14 teams at one neutral site. And is the environment as raucous as it possibly would have been had, you know, Dayton gotten to play, you know, all the home games and UMass gotten to play? I mean, it probably not, but again, I think it's about elevating the status of the game and drawing the media attention to it, being in a place that folks can get to that is accessible to everyone. The women's tournament had, and for all the for all the folks that were saying, oh, the women's basketball tournament has many upsets, it's all chalk. There were more upsets, I think, in the women's
side than there were the
men's. Like, but to the one asterisk I will put on it, almost every single first round upset was a neutral site game. It was not a 1-4 seed losing on their home floor. It was, you know, 5-9 playing on a neutral floor. Now, granted, there were two 10-2s in the second round, which were home game, home courts. But I do think that kind of is interesting. But I do still think the neutral sites promote more upsets. And look, if that's the magic key that gets women's basketball more exposure, maybe, you know, I don't know. I don't have the answers, but it's an interesting thought.
Yeah, I mean, and who knows? I mean, you know, everything could change, you know, in the next couple of years with how any tournament is run. I mean, look at the Bonnies. You know, they won two games, I believe. I know the game against Colorado, they won. Oh, I think three. They won
Oklahoma
three.
Yeah, and they Virginia.
They were the away team against Oklahoma. Yeah, they won three games as the away team in the NIT against, you know, Colorado, Oklahoma, and Virginia. So, I mean, you know, anything could happen, but I do kind of see your point. I mean, some, you know, a lot of people were bringing up the fact that, you know, in pretty much every pro sport, there, aside from the Super Bowl, is the only professional like postseason sporting event that's played at a neutral site. So it's something that those players are used to. But I will say that I'm sure home court advantage, you know, like everything in the difference between college and professional sports, I mean, it plays a lot less of a role. I mean, you've got way more skilled athletes hitting the court, you know, in those events. So, you know, obviously they're a bit less shaken up by a home court, but I would find it very interesting if the first two rounds of the men's tournament were played,
yeah,
on a home court, like maybe if you, you know, a game at like Cameron Indoor or something like that.
They would never do it from a money standpoint. They would lose so much money playing in like a 2,000 seat arena than they would in a 20,000 seat. They'd never do it for Duke.
That's true. I guess that's the other thing I haven't thought about too. You know, the financial part of it.
For schools like Louisville that play in huge arenas, they could finance it fine. Yeah. But you know, for schools like Duke, the NCAA would rather do just about anything.
You're else. Telling me you wouldn't want like a first four game at the Rose Hill Gym? I mean,
I'm not saying I wouldn't. I mean, hey, I was loud and proud on Twitter last year saying put the Final Four in the Palestra. No one will be there anyway. Put in the Palestra. But hey, you know, if we ran the zoo, I tell you.
Yeah, I mean, you know, as co-commissioners of the NCAA, I think we'd do some. Maybe some serious damage, but also maybe some fun stuff. I would honestly
auto bid to the Final Four.
Yeah, Final Four on the aircraft carrier every yep. single year.
It's LaSalle versus someone.
Yeah,
LaSalle Duke on a carrier. Who says no?
But before we, you know, come up with any more, you know, ludicrous ideas and ruin our credibility for our future NCAA commissioner careers, let's talk about, you know, some of the men's teams and how they fared and how they're some of them. Specifically one, are still faring in the 2022 postseason. So first up, let's talk about our two tournament teams. You know, that was Davidson and Richmond. Richmond, obviously, you know, got that upset win against Iowa in that classic 5-12 matchup, and then they kind of got smoked against Providence in the second round. That being said, I think there's a lot. Ending your season on a loss is really tough. And it's one of those things where, you know, when you're a team like Richmond, you're coming into the tournament as the 12th seed. The fates are doing everything in their power to kind of end your season on a loss. You know what I mean? But that first game against Iowa, not only did it, you know, garner so much attention to the program and so much, you know, attention to Richmond in general. But I mean, I think it was a great way to end their season, especially, you know, after their excellent tournament run. So Daniel, you know, how would you evaluate, you know, Richmond's appearance in the tournament this year?
I mean, first and foremost, I would just say that I'm so glad for those super seniors that they got that opportunity. I mean, there's no one more deserving than Jacob Gilliard, you know, Grant Gold and all those folks. I mean, they sat for like 4 or 5 years and listened to all of us clown on them, basically. I mean, we as a media collective and A10 Twitter, I mean, we were relentless on these folks. And
yeah, we are not innocent. Innocent parties at all to that.
And Chris Mooney himself, I mean, by God, his son has become this, I don't know, meme of like just such exuberant joy winning the A-10 championship and then beating, you know, again, a great screenshot of him when they beat Iowa. Like, I mean, you said it yourself, I think, when we talked last week that like they went from like, possibly they lose to Rhode Island in that, you know, second round A-10 tournament game. Mooney maybe gets fired to now he gets a lifetime contract. They went and beat Iowa, who was the hottest team in the country, arguably. Like, I mean, such a tremendous story. And look, there's only going to be four teams any given year. This year it's five because Bellarmine got screwed, but that are going to win their end their seasons on a win. The NCAA champion, the NIT, the CBI, and the TBC, as it's now known as, plus Bellarmine this year because they got screwed out of a tournament bid. Everyone else is going to end up with a loss at the end of their season, which is the sucky part of March. But at the same time, I mean, boy, that win over Iowa was nothing to sneeze at.
Yeah, speaking of the CBI, did you get a chance to watch that right before we hopped on the podcast?
3-hour game.
Yeah, I was watching it with my roommate, who's not really like much of a basketball guy. And, you know, he looked up at one point in double overtime. He's like, "Are we still watching the same game?" I was like, "Yeah." So pretty crazy.
Good for UNC Wilmington, man. Good for them.
But yeah, I mean, in terms of Richmond, I think you really hit the nail on the head. That's pretty funny because I saw that we had changed the banner of the A-10 Talk Twitter page. And that shot that you're talking about on Mooney's son, is that the same picture that's on our banner on Twitter?
I believe so. There's two different ones now of his son going around because there's one from the A-10 championship game and there's one from the win over Iowa. This is the Iowa one, I believe.
Yeah, the one is that his son, though?
I do believe so.
That's so funny. Yeah, I mean, that's just great. I mean, and also, you know, he was bringing his kids. I mean, you saw because we were there in D.C. He was bringing his kids into the press conference room. So, I mean, this is just one of those things where you look back on if you're Chris Mooney or you're, you know, a player on Richmond or even just a Richmond fan, like this season is something you're going to be talking about forever.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? This is something like, you know, the banner's going to be going up in the gym. And it's just going to be, you know, one of the most important chapters in the history of Richmond basketball. But, you know, kind of moving forward with the future of some of these players, Tyler Burton against Iowa had 18 points, 11 rebounds, and 3 steals. You know, putting that together with his 16 point, 12 rebound, you know, performance against Davidson in the, you know, A-10 championship game, does he cement himself as, you know, a solid second round pick in the NBA draft?
Quite possibly. I mean, hard to say, because I truthfully don't know too much about the NBA, you know, draft and where kind of folks sit at. I'm still kind of silently rooting that he will come back to Richmond. The odds of it are probably slim to none, if we're being honest here. But I mean, boy, did he do everything in his power basically to really make a case for himself. I mean, he did himself every favor he possibly could have, I think, in these last couple of weeks by, you know, how he played throughout the A-10 tournament, but especially against Davidson and then against Iowa too. And frankly, he was one of the few people that didn't have a horrible game entirely. Against Providence too. I mean, no one played well, but if anyone played decently, it was probably Burton that night.
Yeah, I mean, they went 1-for-22 from 3-point range in that game. So I mean, it's hard to say that anybody played well.
Yeah,
but I mean, as somebody who does watch, you know, NBA basketball and you know, kind of sees how, you know, what kind of determines people's draft picks. I don't want to say like the NBA draft is all hype based because it's not. It's not, but they're like good tournament performances and good postseason performances are something that really can elevate your draft stock. You know, they kind of set you apart as kind of a middle of the pack guy to, oh, maybe this guy's got some potential, because understandably, I mean, those games are the games where you're under the most pressure. So if you can perform well under those games, of course you're going to, you know, be a good pick. So if I was Tyler Burton, I feel like the move might be to declare now. You know what I mean? Yeah. If he doesn't get drafted, you know, maybe don't hire an agent, you know, do that whole thing. If that's even still a rule with the NIL.
I think it is.
Yeah. So don't hire an agent, but declare for the draft because you can use this resume, because you don't necessarily want to go into another year unless you're ready to be like one of the top 3 players in the conference again. and really cement yourself as like an NBA caliber player. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. No, I think a really good example too of what you're talking about is a guy like Peter Kiss from Bryant, who, led the nation in scoring, didn't really make a lot of people's radar until, they ran through the NEC. And then, even though Bryant didn't win, I think they won their first four games, but they obviously didn't beat the one seed.
They did not win their first four games.
But, they lost. Okay.
No.
But even so, he's a name that people now know. People know Peter Kiss's name because of March Madness.
And you can only be, no offense to Peter Kiss, but like this could really apply to anybody from like the NEC all the way up to the ACC. Like
Max Amos last year was an example of it.
With the amount of guys that play college basketball in a given year, being the number one leading scorer in the country is probably like one of the hardest kind of achievements to earn, you know what I mean? So you can't go into next season thinking, oh, I'm going to run it back and I'm going to do it again. You know what I mean? So that is that one resume point that you need to hold on to, and you need to carry that right into the NBA draft.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, what, the 358 Division I teams, say there's like 10 guys on the roster average, that's 3,580 guys in D1. To be first out of those, tremendous.
But yeah, so a lot of good stuff from Richmond. Hopefully, we'll see, even guys like Jacob Gilliard and Grant Golden. I mean, I don't know if they're necessarily NBA draft caliber, but everything we say against Richmond is something that fuels them even more. So hopefully we'll see them in some professional capacity, in the near future. But first, let's talk about Davidson and their very, very close loss to Michigan. 74-73 in the first round. I don't know if you got a chance to watch this one, Daniel, but I watched probably like the last like five or so minutes of it. I watched the whole game, but I watched the last like 5 or so minutes of it, at dinner. And it was just, Davidson just refused to go down. And, I saw a lot of people talking about, the fouling situation, a lot of people, angry at the referees and whatnot, but I'm not really here to talk about that. You know what I mean? I really am just, so impressed by the way this Davidson team kept fighting. So, I mean, what did you like out of them?
No, I think you make a great point. And referees is kind of something that I feel like is the common denominator that every fan in the world can always point out as the reason their team lost a game. And in that moment, I was the one tweeting from the account saying, folks, the Big Ten whistle's arrived. But at the same time, any coach would always say to anyone, don't put yourself in that position. Don't be in a situation where a referee is going to have a chance to make a game-changing call. Don't be in that close. Make shots, get stops. Don't allow yourself to be in that situation. And when you get in that situation, you still got to fight through it. No one's going to, play a violin for you and feel sorry for you.
Yeah, and that's just how, games end. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Games end with a lot of whistles.
Yeah. So, no, I thought Davidson really played well. I thought there were two or three times I was willing to write them off and say, well, they're dead. And they found, credit Michigan State. They played incredibly hard, obviously incredibly well coached. Davidson was right there to the end. I mean, what they hit that like half quarter as the horn expired to make it like a 1-point loss. They made Michigan State fight for every inch. I don't think any Big Ten team wants to play an A-10 team again after this season.
Yeah. And so kind of talking about wrapping the season up nice with a bow, Davidson, obviously they won the regular season championship of the Atlantic 10. They lost in the final, and then they lost in the first round of the NCAA tournament. Is this the season that Wildcats fans should have wanted? Or do you think, they left a little bit, out on the floor?
I mean, it's hard to say. I mean, they really came out of a surprise, I think. I mean, Davidson came out of nowhere. They were definitely not expected to be anywhere near close to where they finished, I think. None of us were seriously talking about Davidson making the NCAA tournament as an at-large bid, let alone.
Probably not until like January.
Oh, for sure, no. Yeah. Definitely not. Anytime you get to a championship game and you come up a bit short, especially in a close game, there's always going to be that what-if feeling. You left something there on the table type of situation. But absolutely, this is a season Davidson fans should be proud of. I know there's 12 other teams sitting at home on their couches right now saying, damn, I wish that was us. I mean, maybe the Bonas seem to be having a good old time, so maybe there's only 11 of us. But, like, you know, from a GW and George Mason fan, I would gladly trade places in a heartbeat with where Davidson is after this season.
Yeah, and so let's move on to the Bonnies, because, I mean, there's a lot to talk about there, you know, both on and off the court. I know you're just salivating to talk about this coaching situation. But right before that, let's just talk about their current – you know, their current run in general in the NIT. So, last night's game against Virginia, they won 52-51 to punch a ticket to the NIT semifinals in Madison Square Garden, which is going to be on Tuesday. They won this game in the same situation that they lost the game in the quarterfinals against St. Louis, with, you know, Kyle Lofton hit two free throws to win the game against Virginia, and he missed those two free throws against St. Louis in the Atlantic 10 tournament. So, you know, going into that last moment, Daniel, I mean, were you a bit nervous? I mean, I'm sure Bonnie's fans were a bit nervous too.
Yeah, no, it was fun. I didn't watch the whole game. I kind of tuned in right at the right moment as Kyle Lofton was heading to line. I was like, oh, I guess it's a good time to tune in, and kind of saw the situation, and kind of was like, oh boy, because this is, you know, you always feel for a guy that, you know, in his situation that, you know, missed two free throws, which, you know, obviously would have extended their season and through their tournament today. But for him to be able to hit those two shots and knock both of them down calmly, that had to feel good. That's the away team too. Oh yeah. That had to be just very vindicating for him. And I was happy for him. I mean, that's gotta be an awful situation to be in, to miss free throws like that and be able to knock it down. And Oshun with a huge block as well, as time expired. I mean, my God, what a way to punctuate a win.
And it was clean. It was like one of the cleanest Oshun blocks I've ever seen. It was awesome. But yeah, I mean, so, you know, I've been watching their run for pretty much the entire time. And what's so crazy to me is the fact that, you know, we've been talking about the problems with this Bonnie's rotation for so long, and they haven't fixed it. They have not fixed this problem. They had six bench minutes against Oklahoma. They had 14 bench minutes against Colorado. What is going on? Like, how are they able to sustain this? Kyle Lofton has not left the court for St. Bonaventure. Like, if we're, you know, in a hypothetical situation where, you know, these minutes just kind of change from game to game, he has not left the court since maybe like a game against VCU on March 1st. He has played 40 minutes every single game against their regular season finale against Richmond, their game against St. Louis in the A-10 tournament, every single game in the NIT. What is this guy made out of? I mean,
iron. He's Iron Man.
Yeah.
I mean, my God, I mean, this is what's so unique about the NIT as well. And I know everyone's like, oh, the NIT sucks. And people love to rag on the NIT. But as someone watching this from the perspective of a GW fan who watched the 2016 run, NIT is a lot of fun. Like, this is the thing I tweet after the Bonnies won their first game at Colorado. No one wants to be in the NIT until you win your first game. And all of a sudden, you're playing for something that matters against really good teams. I know Joe Lenardi was like, oh, this is the exact reason why we need to expand the field. Don't you ever touch the NCAA tournament. Leave it at 68. Don't you ever expand it. It's perfect.
No, you cannot expand. You cannot expand
the NCAA. But the NIT is a phenomenal tournament for folks, especially that are in the moment enough to be able to understand they're playing still for something that matters. And I mean, I remember having this discussion, and I've mentioned this before on this podcast, about would you rather win an NIT championship or have an NCAA tournament first round exit? And everyone has their opinions, and people are entitled to their own opinions, obviously. But we're sitting here still on March 23rd talking about the only A-10 team still playing, and it is Bonnie. I mean, at the end of the day, they're still playing games and they still matter.
Yeah. And that's an interesting question that you have, you know, in regards to, you know, that would you rather, because I'm thinking about it now and I really couldn't tell you. You know, in terms of an NIT championship or NCAA tournament first round exit, I really think it depends on like where your team kind of exits conference, their conference yeah. tournament. You know what I mean? Like if like let's take Fordham for example, because I'm a Fordham fan. Like if Fordham wins the A-10 tournament and then makes it into the NCAA tournament and then leaves in the first round, I'd rather take that, you know what I mean, than an NIT championship.
And like the run that Richmond just had, no one will take that away from them ever.
They're yeah, like I'd rather have Richmond's run this year than like St. Bonaventure's run right now.
Oh yeah.
Agreed. No offense to St. Bonaventure's run.
No, I fully agreed.
It's awesome. But yeah, and now that the Bonnies are in it, I mean, the Bonnies are also an interesting team too, right? Because in terms of like where they are in their development, where they kind of stand historically as an NCAA program, you know, in the conference that they're in, but also by the fact that the Bonnies are a previous NIT champion.
1973, baby.
77.
Oh, is that what it is?
Yeah, 77.
Yeah, close.
The same year that the first Star Wars came out.
There you go.
And also the same year that the French stopped executing people by guillotine.
Ah, such a shame.
Yeah, actually, Star Wars came out before the last guillotine execution.
I think I've heard that trivia a bit before.
Yeah, it's like one of those weird things. But
like George Washington didn't know there were dinosaurs because they discovered the
land. Yeah.
Here's your history segment on the A10 Talk podcast, folks.
But yeah, so you know, you see people. I'm seeing this on TV, but I mean, the St. Bonaventure fans are really rallying behind this team. And you see, like, they've got shirts now that are like, run it back, like it's 1977.
Yeah.
And we saw how they were, you know, when they were still expected to win the conference. We saw how they were down in Charleston at that game against UConn in New Jersey. And now that they're going to be in Madison Square Garden, which is, you know, I think there's like a really strong St. Bonaventure contingency in New York City.
Oh yeah,
I think the Garden's gonna be rocking on Tuesday night.
It's gonna be great.
I'm definitely gonna be buying some tickets. I'm trying to get like as many people, like, you know, like as many of my friends as I can to go. I mean, specifically because like the tickets are only like $20. Like,
oh hell yeah,
you know what I mean? If you're looking on the right site, so it's gonna be fun. And I really would love to see them close it out. They're going against Xavier in the semifinals, which is gonna be a very interesting matchup. I know Xavier fans, you know, kind of went through a pretty tumultuous season. You know, they were always kind of on the cusp of, you know, being in that Big East like at large conversation, and they really just missed the mark. So, you know, two
and then teams, they went and fired their coach.
And then they fired their coach and now they're in the NIT semifinals. So, you know, I think two teams now, especially with the coaching situation that we've heard today, with some very similar you know, narratives this season, I think it'll be a really fun one. But
oh, absolutely. And then the other half of the bracket, Texas A&M won earlier tonight, and then we've got BYU Washington State in progress still in the first half. So we got three of the four spots in the semifinals all locked up. So
interesting.
A lot of good teams still playing ball here.
Yeah, those are going to be two fan bases that I'll be very interested to see, you know, how well they travel if you know, whoever takes that one, BYU or Washington State. But before we get into that, or, you know, before we talk about, you know, NIT, maybe on a later episode of the podcast, let's talk about this strange roller coaster that went on today in regards to the, you know, the UMass head coaching position and where Mark Schmidt kind of falls into things. So earlier today on Twitter, this account who I had never really heard of before, that a lot of people, you know, were kind of debating their credibility, was saying that Mark Schmidt, his name is Blauds, right? Blauds.
Yeah.
Mark Blauchin, who apparently has experience at the Dallas Morning News, Boston Globe, he was reporting that Mark Schmidt to UMass was a, you know, a hop, skip, and a jump away from being a done deal. They were talking about a contract upwards of $1.8 million. And I know we were talking about Mark Schmidt to UMass for a bit now. I mean, considering the fact that he is a New England guy. But, you know, as soon as this came out, you know, a lot of people were really quick to jump on the fact that might not be entirely reliable. So, Daniel, I mean, I just want to know, like, what you've heard and, you know, how you kind of feel about that whole situation.
It was wild, man. I have to tell you, I believe this is also the same guy, if I'm not mistaken, who leaked like a week or so ago that Kamani Young was going to go to UMass, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes.
Before that all fell apart. And no, I checked. I mean, this is something I've been obviously following, as I think most of us have been over the last several days. And I know Curry Hicks Sage has got like a 20-odd day streak or something insane of like nights in a row doing spaces. And, you know, as we've been through this whole process. And I mean, today, I mean, I said at the top of the show, but it was like whiplash, like back and forth. Frank Martin's out of the picture. Schmidt's got it. It's a done deal. Frank Martin's, oh, in Amherst right now, you know, spotted around town. Oh, Schmidt's, you know, it's a bargaining war between Mark Schmidt and UMass and Bonna. And
what about Rick Pitino?
I mean, crawling out of the woodwork. And I heard John Becker's name pop up in there. I'm like, no, I honestly didn't. I don't think any of us truly knew what to believe. And I don't think any of us are truly going to believe anything until we see a blue check mark saying papers are signed, press conferences tomorrow.
So the Buffalo News, which obviously covers a lot of St. Bonaventure stuff, they've corroborated Mark Blodgen's report that UMass offered a deal between 1.4 and 1.8 million to Schmidt, but you know it was turned down. He withdrew as a candidate. So I mean, I'm sure. So I guess it holds a lot more water than people initially figured. But I just think right now, like considering that you've got a team on their way to an NIT semifinal, as well as the fact that a lot of those guys, people keep talking about how a lot of these guys are already talking about how ready they are to run it back next year. It'd be a weird move for Mark Schmidt, you know?
For sure. I mean, do you think he was playing 4D chess and just using this as a bargaining tool? I mean, it's certainly possible.
Totally. Absolutely. You know, if I could ask on the other side, you know, do you think maybe that he really was considering going to UMass, but then, you know, saw the social media reaction and then withdrew from the conversation? I think that what you suggested is a lot more possible. Because I really don't think most college basketball coaches really care about what people talk about on Twitter.
Yeah.
But it's really interesting. It's just one of those things where I've always like, oh, it's like I kill to be a fly on the wall in these kinds of talks. You know what I mean? Like in these phone calls.
Did you see Kyle Lofton's tweet?
I did not.
He tweeted at 5:49 p.m. tonight. Lol, y'all must be crazy if you think my old man leaving, with two laughing crying emojis.
Well, that looks good for, yeah. I mean, you know, I'm sure Coach Schmidt's got a great relationship with these players considering they've been here for so long.
And he only gets five of them.
And I'm sure, you know, I think that tweet, you know, I don't want to be like the Entertainment Tonight, like TMZ guy that's like, well, here's what he's really saying about, you know, on social media. But I'm sure there's a bit of like, you know, yes, laughing at all of us as he should be, you know, for, you know, just, you know, jumping on all these speculation trains and whatnot. But there might be a little bit of relief, you know what I mean, from a player like that who's like, okay, our coach is not leaving. We've got another year. Like, let's run it back. And I think depending on not even, you know, no matter what happens on Tuesday and then potentially on Thursday at the Garden, I think, you know, the Bonnies will be heading into the offseason with a lot to build on and, you know, a lot of motivation to, you know, like run it back and keep pushing.
For sure. And if I could throw one more thing in here too, before we move on, credit the Bonnies for keeping their heads together last night. I mean, a lot of teams would have folded. Hell of a lot of distraction going on around the program as they're playing, you know, NIT quarterfinal game at University of Virginia. And the guys kept their heads together, took care of business, won the game in front of them at a time where, I mean, who knows what the message was to the team from Schmidt about whether he'd even addressed it or not. Players had to know. I mean, we live in the 21st century. Guys knew the rumors. For them to get the win and the way they did, I give them a lot of credit.
Yeah. And so speaking of, you know, head coaching stuff, there's been a lot going on, you know, within the A-10, obviously. So right now, just so everyone's tracking, going into next season, there's now going to be four new coaches in the Atlantic 10. Out of those four new coaches, we only know exactly one of them. And that's Archie Miller.
The return of Archie.
Yes, the return the return of Archie Miller, this time, you know, after spending, you know, many seasons at Dayton. I believe he took him to an Elite Eight. Yes, he took him to an Elite Eight.
So
a round of 32. He took him to the Elite Eight in 2014.
There we go.
He'll be returning to the Atlantic 10 this time at URI. And that was announced literally the day the last episode of the podcast came out. So on March 18th, last Friday. So Daniel, I mean, I would just love to, I wish we had a Dayton guy on here, because I would love to, you know, see what they had to say about it. But, you know, for now, I guess I'll pick your brain. What do you think of this hire? I think it's very interesting.
Absolute slam dunk. Best hire. I mean, unless John Calipari walks through the door in Amherst, I think this is the best hire of any A-10 team this offseason. I say that before GW's made a hire, before LaSalle's made a hire, before UMass has finally figured out what the hell's going on there. I think this is the best hire of the offseason. I know Archie struggled at Indiana, and say what you want to say, but he's a guy that's proven to win at the Atlantic 10 level. And really, that's what we're after here. We don't care about how many Big Ten championships you did or didn't win at IU. We don't care. All we care about is, can you be successful at this level? And he's shown that time and again. I mean, I grew up watching this guy. He was so beloved by the Dayton fans. I'm really curious to see what that reception is going to be when he walks into UD Arena next time. Is he going to be, you know, beloved and celebrated, or is he going to be like, damn, we hate this guy? I mean, it's going to be really interesting to kind of see how that goes.
I mean, what do you think? Because, I mean, he, you know, he finished his career at Dayton 139-63, took Dayton to four consecutive NCAA tournaments. But his last 2 years, he finished with the conference regular season championship both times, but did not win the tournament. They did not win the A-10 tournament. So do you think, you know, there was a little bit of unfinished business that Dayton fans might be, you know, they might think like, oh, you left too soon. You know what I mean? Like, you hopped out of it, you know, as soon as you could have. Or do you think they'll be a bit more thankful than that?
I don't know. It's hard. I mean, the circumstances in which he left Dayton have always been a little bit murky. My understanding of it is the money was not the issue. It was not that Dayton wasn't going to give him enough money. It was kind of sounds like he was ready to move on. And Dayton also, whether they wanted to admit it or not, I think was also, at least from an administrative level, was willing to let him move on too. That being said, I would not be shocked if he's met by resounding amounts of boos.
Yeah, I mean, people love to boo. You know, they'll find any reason to boo.
They're Ohio people. What else do they have to do up there? No shade, Ohio. Well, a little bit. But
they're an angry state
in Ohio. Hey, I'm a Kentucky boy at heart. I got to throw a little shade across the Ohio River if I can.
So, yeah, a lot of interesting stuff.
I got to rep it. I'm wearing the Kentucky home shirt. I got to, you know, rep it a little bit.
Oh, of course, of course.
And I'll throw in, you know, when we get to GW here about Mike McGee's too. Yeah. Because that's a little rumor going around too.
So also another new head coaching vacancy. Now, LaSalle, Ashley Howard has been let go about 2 days ago. So Daniel, I mean, do you like this move? And who do you think could come in and maybe fix this LaSalle program? Before you say that, I'll just give my thoughts. Like, I really think
for it.
It's not that I like this move. I don't like to see anyone fired, but I mean, there was really nothing. I couldn't really think of anything that Ashley Howard was really building on. I really did not see an identity with this team. And I think that's the biggest problem. So I think the biggest thing is, like, you got to find a coach that, you know, that builds a good culture. Cause LaSalle is a passionate fan base. I mean, you know, you look at the Gola boys, you know, I think that's pretty much like a general attitude around this program, you know, a lot like Fordham. I see a lot of parallels to Fordham in this program. And I think there are a lot of people that are ready to get behind the team if they find a good coach. But I was just wondering, you know, what do you think about that? Do you agree?
Yeah, no, I think you hit the nail on the head here. I'm not sure there's a whole lot for me to expand upon. It was probably time for Ash Howard. I mean, he just never found footing at LaSalle. And as I recall, his first year, it took like 12 games to even get his first win, and he had to do it in that little MTE and Boardwalk Hall, as I recall. I mean, of course, they had a couple bizarre wins every year because Tom Gola Arena is a house of horrors for any A-10 team with anything above two wins, it feels like, in the league. But, I mean, we were joking in the Mason circles of, you know, even if whenever George Mason this year wasn't up to save Ash Howard's job. But, I mean, look, he's a good guy. I hope he'll land on his feet somewhere. He certainly proved he was a darn good assistant to Jay Wright. Wherever he goes, I wish him the best. Really, the question is going to be, what's the financial investment that LaSalle puts into it? I know there's been rumors about this new arena thingy. I have no idea how tangible it is, if it's, you know, how serious this is, what it's going to look like. If LaSalle's committed, I mean, this has been the thing we've been saying about LaSalle for a while. They've been kind of sitting on the fence about their commitment. If they're going to go all in, we're going to find out, I think, sooner rather than later.
Yeah, no, that's a great point. It's interesting. You know, I don't know if this is something that happens with a lot of schools, but maybe LaSalle finds himself in a position where it's like, oh my God, like, we spent all this money on renovating our gym that we forgot to, you know, shell out the cash for a coach. But I think they'll be fine. And I think Ashley Howard will be fine as well. It's hard to, you know, it's hard to not find a job when you're, you know, when you've come under the Jay Wright coaching tree. And who knows what that means, you know, whether or not he'll be an assistant somewhere else, maybe like Matt McCall. You know, wish nothing but the best for the guy. Absolutely. I think he'll be fine going forward. Before we finish up tonight, let's talk about a little bit some guys that, you know, we saw in the transfer portal today. You know, as always, you know, you've been keeping up on a10talk.com with this really great, you know, constantly updating transfer portal kind of, you know, checker. And, you know, you put down some guys today, but even as, you know, the day kind of went on, I think there might have been a couple that you have not had a chance to talk about yet. Three guys that I saw right before we got on the podcast was Jimmy Nichols Jr. on VCU, SLU's Andre Lorenzen, and LaSalle's Khalil Brantley. Obviously, we'll probably be seeing a bit more LaSalle guys, you know, trickle out of the program as the days go on, because they just lost their head coach. But Daniel, I mean, is there any, you know, recent transfer that kind of sticks out to you?
Yeah, I mean, I'll be a homer here for the sake of it. GW is decimated. I mean, they lost Ricky Lindo Jr., Breon Freeman, and Joe Bamazel. I mean, the cupboard is bare in Foggy Bottom right now from a talent standpoint. I mean, no disrespect to the guys still around, but that's like 80%, I think, of the offensive production from this team this year. And none of it's a surprise. Hell, I thought, I was convinced Brown was going to transfer even if Jamie in state, just because I thought he was destined for greater things. And, you know, obviously there's been no movement yet fully on the GW coaching job. Chris Caputo sounds like he's got the inside job. I know Louisville's Mike Pegues has been thrown around, as well as John Becker. We'll see, you know, whoever they end up with and what they can bring in through the portal. Obviously, Caputo's still, you know, dancing in the Sweet 16 with Miami. But boy, GW's cupboard is bare right now.
Yeah, I mean, the Brand Freeman, it wasn't surprising to me, but I totally have to agree with you. What sucks about GW is that I really feel like that if a lot of those guys stayed, there could have been something very interesting to build on. You know what I mean? I mean, a lot of those guys were really, really good. They seem to play together very well, but I mean, it's just one of those things that you see. It's like they don't have their guy, you know, coaching, that they're not going to want to stay there. So pretty unfortunate for George Washington, but you know, it's just one of those things where you got to enter a rebuild again. But if I could, you know, brag for a second, we haven't had a single outgoing Fordham transfer this offseason. Very interesting. I just gotta say.
And let's not bury the lead here too. Didn't Kyle Neptune win a pretty big award this week as well?
He was nominated for an award for, that's gonna be the best first year head coach of the year. I'm not sure when that award gets tallied and released, but yeah, he is a nominee. And I gotta say, I mean, he's a pretty good candidate.
Yeah,
you know what I mean?
I know we talked last time about how we would have voted him coach of the year. I mean, no one wants any bit of Fordham right now.
Yeah, so, you know, a lot of good stuff for Fordham, a lot of good stuff for a lot of these programs. And, you know, with that, I think we'll wrap up this episode of the A10 Talk podcast. Once again, I'm Sam Basil alongside Daniel Frank. You know, keep checking updates on all your 15 favorite teams in the country. Check out a10talk.com. Join our new Twitter community and follow us on Twitter at A10Talk. A lot of good stuff, I'm sure, is going to be coming there in the next couple days, next couple months. And on Tuesday, make sure you check out St. Bonaventure in the NIT semifinals. And with that, I think we'll see you guys next time.